Welcome, friends, to the Enduring Gifts of Marvin Gaye podcast, brought to you by your 26-year listening veteran, Jessica. Join me as we celebrate these enduring gifts, the songs of Marvin Gaye. In each episode, I will share insights about the music and recount life experiences tied to it. I'm hoping to inspire you to take a first or your 500th first listen to these songs that are truly the enduring gifts of Marvin Gaye.
Welcome to the episode, I'll Never Stop Loving You, Baby, from the You're All I Need 1968 album recorded by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. I'm going to explore the duet partnerships that Marvin had throughout his career. I'm going to explore something that I recently came across, a television interview about given by some actors in a play on Marvin's life. And this play was localized to Detroit. I will explain Jan Gay's take on Marvin's relationship with Tammy. And then I'm going to also just point out some information that came out of a TV1 unsung documentary on Tammy Terrell's life, and finish out by highlighting why you need to listen to I'll Never Stop Loving You, Baby. Okay, so here we go. So one thing I'm going to point out is that this song right now is out of sequence of my listening exposure to Marvin Gaye. The last episode that I recorded was Shadow of Your Smile, and I apologize for the tragic elements to that. I have been racking my brain of what content there is to cover from here on out, and I think I can ensure that that will be the only sad episode, period. But the next bit of music that I chronologically came across after the Marvin Gaye collection is the album What's Going On. And it's been in the process of starting this podcast, as I'm doing so much research on Marvin. It's actually this experience has been just the time of my life for me. So, you know, that's the only thing that I get out of it, that's the only thing I need to get out of it, because it finally feels like this passion is being placed in a very productive place. Not that it ever felt like it was, you know, not, but it is definitely something that has consumed a lot of my time throughout my life. And to just be able to, make something out of that feels very constructive. I don't know. It makes it feel worthwhile. It makes it feel worth something. Guys, I hope that this audio will sound much better. I have been experimenting with the different ways I've been trying to record these episodes so far, and I think I may have found the sweet spot. So, the 1968 album, right? And in the month or so here that I've been doing the research and just getting my hands on as much Marvin Gaye material as I can, like I said, I'm having the time of my life, and it's just really filling my cup. It's a finally experiencing what people talk about when they say they get to kind of work at their passion, right? Like they're doing something that is their passion, and it is very fulfilling. So in recent weeks here, I came across this YouTube video that was a interview by a local Detroit news station guy speaking to these actors in a play that was coming out about Marvin Gaye's life in Detroit. The play was happening in Detroit, and it was a play of Marvin Gaye's entire life. And they were asked, you know, to just talk about this play. which they were doing, but, and I don't even think they intended for this to be basically the takeaway that I got of what they were telling me their play was about. But they, one of the actors made the statement, and I will explain again, it was supposed to have been a play about Marvin Gaye's entire life because they had two actors that played Marvin. One was in the early 1960s up until the 70s, and then the other actor steps in and he has a beard, right? And then he's going to take it from the 70s until the end of Marvin's life. So it was supposed to be a play about his entire career, let's put it like that. And then one of them just said this, and then I was just like, wow, wow. They said Marvin Gaye, there were basically two Marvin Gayes. There was the Marvin Gaye before Tammy Terrell died, and there was the Marvin Gaye after Tammy Terrell died. And they just said that, and they didn't, you know, say anything else, and then the guy was asking the next questions. And I was just like, oh my gosh, dude, like, you're doing a play on Marvin Gaye's life, and you just kind of synopsized it in that one statement right there. But I have to, that statement has stayed in the back of my mind. And that's been a couple of weeks back now that I came across that interview since then. And it really has been impacting and influencing my thought processes of how I can even go about approaching, discussing some upcoming songs of Marvin's. Because getting to this song right here, this album, the context of Marvin and Tammy is very much out of sequence from my previous episode, which was in still sequence. I go from listening to the Marvin Gaye Collection, which is a previous episode, and the next thing that happens in sequence of me experiencing Marvin's music is I get into the What's Going On album, and I just take my time through that song by song by song. And so in honor of, you know, recording these episodes in that sequence, which I started out to say I needed to do, I would be on the What's Going On album right now. But it really, that statement, I'm just telling you, it's kind of just, I can get next to it. You know what I'm saying? And because I can, it's really taking up a lot of my thought processes about Marvin's music. Because that is such a paramount statement to make, right? Someone coming in and coming out of their life made them two different people. It was like the person that they were before that person died and the person that they were after that person died. It's in my way, in a way, to be able to move forward into discussing Marvin's songs before I would address the Tammy Terrell music that he made with her, right? So it's like, I personally don't come to this album until I am 15. Let's go to my acquiring my music back in these days, right? I am, every chance that I get, I want to go to the Best Buy because I've just done a new babysitting job. I have a new $20 bill. That's about how much these discs are costing, $20 and under usually. If it's a double disc expanded version, it might be a little bit more. But I will, you know, budget for that and be ready to go get that. So in these, it's like 2 years now that I'm doing this because I get this disc when I'm 15. One time I've gone to the Best Buy and they have now got You're All I Need, the album You're All I Need, which is released in 1968 with Tammy and Marvin. And I see it and I don't leave with it because when I would go to Best Buy, sometimes they would have videotapes. They would have, and they were VHS, dude. They were videotapes. So, but I do remember, and I think this is how it happened, that this one time I went to Best Buy and it was the first time that I was seeing the You're All I Need disc, but I don't leave the store with it because I think what I left the store with instead was this little documentary videotape of Marvin. And that has always been, for me, like the most exciting part about experiencing Marvin's music is when I get to actually see him performing it. And I think that's the reason why I'm getting so much excitement out of my Pinterest page, is because it's all the visual aspect of Marvin. I love to see pictures of Marvin, which I have a wall full of them that I've collected over the years. And so, yeah, I wake up to that every morning. Like, I just need to see Marvin first thing in the morning. So, yeah, a visual element of Marvin is very integrated into the overall experience of mine. So, yeah, when and this was the first time that I was seeing a videotape of Marvin, and it was of all of this archive back in the 1960s television performance footage of him. And so I was like, oh, hands down, gotta get this videotape. So I left the store leaving You're All I Need right there. But let's go back to how I've explained. That's a roll of the dice, right? Am I gonna find it there next time I make it over to the store? It might not still be there. And so there was this one time that we were on the road. We were not heading to Best Buy, but we were in the neighborhood of Best Buy. We were on the highway near Best Buy, and I had money, and I was like panicking now because I really wanted to get that disc as well. I just had to budget for it, right? And so I remember asking if we could kind of go out of our way because we were just in the vicinity, but and we weren't that had not been anybody's plan to go over there, but we were in the vicinity, and could we please just take this little deviation to go over to Best Buy so that I could go see if they still had that disc, because I needed to get that, and that would be the only thing I would run in. If they had it, I'd get it and I'd come right back out. And I just couldn't like negotiate to make that happen. So, I was just told, we'll do it another time. We'll do it another time. And I was hurt by that. I was very hurt because it just kind of felt like they didn't get it, right? Like I didn't have like full on support for just like how truly important this whole music acquisition process was for me. So I remember I was hurt. So a couple of weeks later, it is my birthday, and so my family comes in to go ahead and I remember they came into my bedroom. It might have been that morning then. It had to have been in the morning time where they just all come in to sing me happy birthday and give me my presents. And they hand me my presents and I open it and it is the You're All I Need disc. So that explained it to me. And then I felt bad because I was like, oh, they couldn't take me to Best Buy to go get that disc because I'm pretty sure they already had it for me. They knew I wanted it. They knew how much I wanted it. They knew how important this thing is to me. It very much was just, it made me so happy to see that, they got it. They understood. And so,
And just to explain who I was as a student at this time, I was your total definition, epitome definition of a schoolgirl, right? Like that used to be the term that people used for people such as myself in high school at that time. A schoolgirl, a nerd, and just rep for it. I'm proud of that. I did very well in school. Pushed myself very hard in school, and these were the years that I was really getting after it. So everything was just about like being very studious for me, right? Like I was a very serious student, and I can see that I was very studious about my study of Marvin Gaye here because for whatever reason, I had taken the time to, and on my school paper, the college ruled paper that you always had to have for school, I came across these college ruled lined pieces of paper where I had in my most pristine, immaculate, cursive handwriting that I could produce, dude. Just and so it's beautiful. I'm looking, I was like, wow, my handwriting is so beautiful on this. I was very serious about this. I wrote out Marvin Gaye's chronology and I wrote it out. Oh my gosh, I did two things. I wrote it out by hand. And so I'm looking at these pages of my own handwriting, just repeating the chronology that I already had copies of, just album by album, every song on the album, year that it was released, just beautiful pages of that. Then from there, because this was the time frame, we had just gotten a computer in the house. And from there, I took it from my handwriting and then I typed it up. And then I had this little paragraph at the beginning of what I typed up, and it was like, this is the full list of Marvin's albums, and let's keep in mind, I know there are some greatest hit compilations out there, and I don't know if I've bothered to include those, but I will go through this list and I will underline the titles that I already have in my collection. It was just like,
This was so serious to me. It was so important. It was so, you know, just my work, dude. I was working. I have been working at Marvin, but happily, you know what I'm saying? It's my passion. But since the beginning, this has not ever been a joke to me. Okay. This has not ever been not serious to me. So I was just looking at that. I was like, oh my gosh, I was such a, that's what I spent my time doing, little girl. You know what I mean? I was a good little girl. I was not messing around with any stuff that, you know, thank goodness I wasn't messing around with at that point in time yet. So, yeah, it's just always been real, real serious. And let's just, let me get kind of back on track here. I said that I was going to point out Marvin's duet history and how he got to the place of, you know, doing duets in his career. So let's go there. I started with kind of how it ended up being very lucky for all concerned, right? Us as the listener and Marvin as the ability to be an artist, having, you know, the ability to fully explore his artistic vision, that he got to be a solo artist. Because I was thinking of the pantheon of performers that were at Motown, you know, at that exact same time. And let's even go to how Marvin gets to Detroit in the first place. I pointed out previous episode, he was with the Moonglows, Harvey Fuqua and the Moonglows. And at some point, I feel that I've heard or read, you know, that before they actually made it to Detroit, that the entire group disbanded. Because like I said, the group was Harvey's and he kind of rotated out his doo-woppers. So once he picked up Marvin, he picked up, like, I feel like the whole group that was, with Marvin in DC. And then from there they went on tour and they got to Detroit, and by the time that they got to Detroit, like, intact and just still deciding to be associated with each other was Marvin and Harvey. And I feel like I'm saying, like, before they got to Detroit, at some stop, you know, in between town or two back, they had just decided as a collective group to part ways. So these other singers, you know, went their own ways. And one thing that I did recently hear from the very first little documentary I was watching that inspired my very first episode. In that same documentary, they were pointing out how the Moonglows did get a record deal with Bo Diddley's Records. And I believe that was in Washington, D.C. So that's how I believe that they recorded that material that I was listening to the other day. But, you know, it didn't last very long. And I don't think that they put out more than one album together, that group, that specific group of people. And so, you know, they kept moving further west until they made it to Detroit, and they got connected with Berry Gordy. I believe that Harvey kind of had connections and knew who Berry was, and then Marvin was just teamed up with Harvey, so that was his introduction in. And, you know, let's look at who's going on at Motown at that time, right? It's like I said, it's in its infancy. And, you know, Marvin literally got to get into the Motown experience, the Motown organization, really from the ground floor up. They had not been in existence for very long. They had not done a whole lot yet. And Marvin really got in on the ground floor to where, you know, he started out being a drum player. He did not start out right off the bat being a signed solo artist. You know, I think that he did what he could do around the company first, and then he got his shot at being a solo artist. But that, it went back to that song from the Moonglows that I heard of, you know, with Marvin in it. But it's like, where's Marvin? You know, you can't crystal clearly distinguish where Marvin's vocal is falling into place in that song. And it's just, that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's the best thing that happened for everybody involved, that Marvin was able to break out of a band group type of situation, and that he didn't have to put in years and years and years into his early career recording songs where we don't really get to fully hear Marvin Gaye's voice, right? Like, he did not have to have an experience of for years and years and years in his early career, he's blended in. He didn't have to go the route of a Justin Timberlake. You know what I mean? He didn't have to be a mega superstar solo act capability, but he had to be tied to a group for years and years and years before he could break out and be on his own. He didn't have to go the route of a Beyonce. You know what I mean? Like, Marvin didn't have, we, thank goodness for us, we don't have to have, you know, a good portion of Marvin's catalog where we don't just only get to experience Marvin. So, but he even had to pay a little bit of his dues to get to that place where, thank goodness, he got to bypass all of that. And the only reason why I was really thinking about that is because, like I said, let's look at who's on board at Motown right at that time. We've got Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. We've got the Four Tops. And there is the main lead singer of the Four Tops, Levi, what's his name? I'm so sorry, I don't know this man's name. But that's going to paint my picture here. You've got the Four Tops and you've got the lead singer, Levi. And then you've got the Temptations, right? And they kind of go back and forth between it being David Ruffin and Eddie Kendrick singing lead. But then who else is in the Temptations, right? There's Otis. There was a guy named Paul, right? You know, there were groups. There were a lot of groups there at Motown. And thank goodness Marvin got to not be lumped into a group. So Marvin was a solo artist. So why did duets become a part of his career as well? Because it wasn't necessary, you know? Marvin was a solo artist. It wasn't really necessary for Marvin to have been paired up with anybody. You know, he really, it wasn't necessary. But I taught myself, simply by looking at this Marvin Gaye collection chronology, exactly kind of why there was a reason that Marvin took on doing duets. I'm looking at it right now. So we get from Marvin the Soulful Moods of Marvin Gaye in 1961. And we've already discussed it didn't sell. You know what, though? I don't even really want to say it like that. It didn't sell. Because somebody bought it. You know what I mean? That thing sold some copies. People bought that album. And I tied that into this podcast. You know what I mean? I have some listeners. I look at my listen count. And I will say, like, when I was first attempting to get this all set up and episodes uploaded and stuff, I would be listening to it over and over and over again to just try and check the sound quality. I'm listening to it on this device. I'm listening to it on a phone. I'm listening to it on a TV. I'm listening to it on the computer. I'm listening to it at the computer at work. I'm listening to it with headphones, without headphones. So I'm just continuing to listen to the different episodes to, like, and I'm asking everybody I know, can you listen to it and listen to it on this and listen to it on that and tell me, can you hear it right? Because when I listen to it on this, I can't quite hear it. And so I listen to that thing, I know, so many times. And for a little bit there, my analytics weren't coming through. And then the first time that I got some analytics, I had like 20 listens. And I was like, you know what, though? I think I gave myself every single one of those listens, because how long has it been tracking my analytics, right? I think I gave myself every single one of those listens. And then there have been times that I'm still listening. I just want to make sure the quality is somewhat audible. I know I'm not at a professional level with this yet, so I know I could get to this place where it's going to sound so much better. But in the meantime, right, I'm dealing with what I have access to. And so I continue to listen, and I will see my little count grow up, and I'm like, yeah, but I think I'm giving myself those listens. Until finally one day, though, I was able to see this other part of my analytics, and I'm going to just shout out right now, shout out my listeners. I could see I have listeners in Germany and Australia. So, like, hey, guys, like, that is the coolest thing in the world to me. And, you know, it just goes to back to Marvin's first record. Every single listen counts. You know what I mean? And, you know, every single listen is appreciated. I know Marvin appreciated every single sale of that first record. I appreciate every single listen that comes through. It all counts. So I don't want to say it disrespectfully like that. Like, I didn't sell. Well, it sold something, and each one counts. You know what I mean? Because you got to start from somewhere. But it was not a hit, right? And there's a difference between, hey, you know, my mama bought my record and you finally have a hit. So there is that first record, and then the following record we've already discussed. It comes out a year and a half later, but it gives him hits, right? He breaks through. He's got his hits. The album that follows that is called Recorded Live on Stage. That's just, and actually that's what it says in the little column here. But when I look at the album cover itself, it in very large letters says Marvin Gaye. And then it must say Recorded Live on Stage above that. But that album I have recently been able to hear through Spotify, and it's everything. Oh my gosh, I love that little album. That's a jamming little album. And where I knew that those recordings had to have come from is that was the time, those were the early years in Motown. When does this album get released? It's in August of 63. Those are the years that Motown as a company, as an organization, as all artists that are on board at Motown are doing the Motown Review. So they go around touring the country and they're doing, I don't think they go like far west, but they go like north to south. So they're doing a lot of performances down south. And this is during Jim Crow times, dude. This is during legalized segregation. This is during, that is not necessarily the safest thing for any black person to be doing, traveling down in the south of the United States at that time. Performing. Going into places where you are going to be allowed to be on the stage, but you're not going to be allowed to use the facilities. You're going to be allowed to, you know, come in through the back door to get to the stage, but you're not going to be able to freely go sit down and order some food. You know what I mean? And so it, and it's just, you kind of need to stick to your route, and you guys definitely need to stick together as a group. So that was what was going on, but that is where the material for that album came from. And then from there, he follows up with When I'm Alone, I Cry, which is a full on in the vein of jazz, sound. There's no Motown sound associated with that. And okay, and then here we get to some important statistics here. That album, When I'm Alone, I Cry, comes out in April of 1964. In April of 1964, Marvin Gaye's Greatest Hits gets released. And in April of 1964, Together with Mary Wells gets released. Marvin Gaye has three albums come out the same month, the same year. And there was a reason for that, because what's the first one that I just said? It's called When I'm Alone, I Cry, and it maybe sold two more copies than the first one sold. Oh my gosh, but I am thinking to myself right now, when I was able to acquire this album, and I was 17 when that one came out, so I was a few years into my very studious study of Marvin Gaye, and I was able to get my hands on When I'm Alone, I Cry, and that album is every single thing. And that album is only his fourth album, and it's only his second attempt at the music. And I want to like correct any type of an impression that I had previously made about Marvin's ability to deliver these songs. This album, don't sleep on it. Get it. Listen to it. It's on Spotify. You need to listen to this album. Marvin delivers the songs. And that's coming from somebody who has never heard a rendition of any one of these songs on this album sung by anybody else but Marvin. So my first time hearing these songs is the first time I'm able to open up, rip open this CD, put in my headphones, press play, let's go. And I did that one without reading liner notes first. And I'm listening to that and I am captivated by it. And it was a it was one disc, but it was a double issue of these songs. The first, it's 10 songs, I feel like, because there's 20 songs on the disc. And the first 10 were just given to you in mono, and then it goes into the exact same 10 songs again, and it's given to you in stereo. So it's just like the sound quality is a little bit better. And it's just magical. Oh, and I just love that album so much. And Marvin is just singing songs on this album, and it's just like, I refuse. You cannot convince me. I won't accept that you're trying to tell me that Marvin Gaye wasn't able to sing jazz music, okay? That he wasn't able to deliver the jazz sound in a very unique and very skillful way. That album, he has it. If I have given any type of an impression that he wasn't able to approach the music, I really was trying to tie that to his confidence level at that very first album. But Marvin, and I'm looking at this right now, he made, let me count in total, he made 1, 2, 3, 4 full on in the vein of jazz music, no Motown sound associated with that in those early 1960s years, okay? Motown let Marvin do that exercise 4 separate times. And, you know, they didn't sell a lot of records with that. So when we go to the music business, right? Like, that's what's going to keep you in the game. Thank goodness, you know, with something like this, if I was trying to make my living by doing this podcasting right now, well, I'm not there. You know what I'm saying? I can't do that yet. So there's always some type of a financial aspect to, you know, trying to make a living at what you're doing. And if what you're trying to do to make a living requires you to make some money at doing it, then, you know, by this time, Marvin was not able to do that yet because he's not generating the sales that are needed for a record company to stay wanting to back him. But this is how I saw that everybody was trying to win in this situation with Marvin's music right here, right? They worked with him to allow him to have this full-on artistic vision realization when he records When I'm Alone, because Marvin has full pieces. He's got the full orchestra. Remember, I'm not a musician, so I can't tell you the technicality of things, but I know there's a section of strings, right? And then there's this, you know, it's like a symphonic, orchestral, whatever those different sections of an orchestra are. You've got your strings and you've got your horns, but I know it's not called the horns section, right? And then you've got your different percussions, and it's just everything comes together. He has that. It's that full on, beautiful, rich sound. Motown gave him what he needed to really create the sound. So he's got that. They're investing in him with that. But it's, they already off of the bat, they know it's not going to sell. So they come out with 2 other albums for him to release. Were they coming out on the exact same day? I know music used to always come out on Tuesdays. So maybe these came out 3 weeks in a row in April, right? There was something else that I watched just recently about what a greatest hits means to an artist. And it was the actual, I believe it was an unsung biography on the band The Jets from the 1980s. And so they were interviewing The Jets and they were talking about how just all of a sudden their career took a nosedive because they lost the backing of their record label. They were about to get cut. They lost their management, blah, 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 blah. And so they still had like a commitment to make a certain number of records. And so a way that the record company satisfied that for them was they didn't even allow them. They didn't fund them to get into the studio to record fresh music. They were like, okay, you owe us an album. Guess what you get is a greatest hits album. And so this guy was explaining that, like, actually for artists, a lot of the time, a greatest hits album is kind of like writing on the wall that you could kind of be at the skin of your teeth, as being able to keep your record deal going when they're giving a greatest hits release for you. Because think about that. They're not really allowing you to record any fresh music. They're just compiling stuff and putting that out as a part of your obligation of what you owe them. So, you know, maybe there was a little bit of writing on the wall with this Marvin Gaye's greatest hits that comes out the exact same month as When I'm Alone, I Cry. But here is where they were really trying to work with Marvin, is that exact same month, the album Together with Mary Wells. This is segueing me into the purpose and the reason and the need for, it was necessary for Marvin to do a duet. because at that time, Mary Wells, oh my guy, I just now remembered what Mary Wells' song was that she had that was a million copy seller. And I do believe it was the first million copy seller for Motown as an overall organization. And the name of the song was My Guy. Mary Wells is fresh off of her million copy selling hit, My Guy. So she is a strong member of the team right there, right? And Marvin needed some help with his sales. Not that Marvin, you know, can't sing and he can't hold his own and he can't deliver a song and he can't really make a hit, but that Marvin's been really granted some access to do this jazz music. And let me put it to you like this. Let me put that into context for you like this. And it will be very contextual in just a second here. I'm going to ask you a question. Did you know that Motown released pure jazz records in the 1960s? At the height of all of their Motown sound hits. Did you know that? They just had some like full on non-Motown sound, pure to jazz, pure to the form of jazz, full on albums that they produced and released. Did you know that? Did you know that Motown did that? You did not know that Motown did that because these records didn't really sell a whole lot. They had one artist on their roster. Okay, here's something you've probably heard associated with Marvin, the Prince of Motown. This is why. They were working with him. Okay, he's the only artist on their roster that had full-on jazz records that have absolutely nothing to do with Motown sound. Marvin, and I promise you, listen to these albums. There is no element of Motown sound. Marvin is not Motown sounding these jazz standards that he is recording. These are true to the art form of jazz, full-on records that Motown produced and released and distributed for Marvin. So yes, Marvin, Prince of Motown, that's where it comes from. You know, I feel like when they espouse that title about Marvin, they meet it in a kind of negative way that like he had a little bit of a complex about it. I don't agree. I just know Marvin was an artist and he had an artistic vision and he did not compromise from it. So it's actually just the fact that Motown worked with him that proves the compromising that went on between the two parties there. But see, that's if I put that to you like that, if I take you back to the height of the 1960s, My Guy, Wait a Minute, Mr. Postman, the songs by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the songs by the Four Tops, My Girl, the songs by the Temptations, which you even had Gladys Knight and the Pips there at the time. You had Junior Walker. You had all of these, this pantheon of the, okay, who did I totally leave out? The Supremes, right? Like you had all of that music and buried into that were these full on, nothing but jazz, full albums that were coming out by one person at Motown. So, and they weren't selling though, unfortunately. So, you know, at this 1, 2, 3, 4th album into the game, Motown works with them. They let him release that. They give him also a greatest hits album that exact same month because they're trying to remind people, hey folks, he's got some albums. And let me even tell you what albums or songs are on there. Can I Get a Witness? You're a Wonderful One. Stubborn Kind of Fellow. I'm Crazy About My Baby. Pride and Joy, Hitchhike. I've never heard that song. Hold on. I can't even keep going because I've never heard that song, I'm Crazy About My Baby. I'm going to have to find that song right now. Hitchhike, Sandman, Hello There Angel, One of These Days, I'm Yours, You're Mine, Taking My Time, It Hurt Me Too. Okay. They're reminding folks, Marvin Gaye has hits. Okay. Marvin Gaye has hits. If you're not feeling his jazz approach, he still has hits. And guess what? We're also going to partner him with our biggest star at the moment, because this is pre the Supremes having a million copy hit. Like I'm telling you, Mary Wells, My Guy was the very first million copy hit for Motown. They pair Marvin with their highest selling artist at the time because they're backing him. They're trying to believe in Marvin. So that was the necessity of Marvin's first duet album. At that point, that actually was a necessity for Marvin's career. And they got some hits out of that. Well, they got a hit out of it. They got Once Upon a Time. But that was like a one-stop shop. It was a definite, at this moment in time, we need to help you, you know, just stay relevant. And so we're partnering you with our biggest artist at the moment. And so that's the need for Together with Mary Wells. Now, one thing I did point out that I just observed from that record is that it's ancient sounding compared to kind of like all of the rest of Marvin's recordings, even of at that time, even definitely compared to the instrumentation that is going on with When I'm Alone, I Cry. That album seems kind of almost like very, well, you know what? Don't let me go into the album because I will honestly say I have not deeply dived, explored that entire album. But the song Once Upon a Time is very stripped down. It's very archaic, ancient sounding. It just has this very, it's like it, you just know you're hearing very, very, very early Marvin Gaye right there. It's just like bare bones, but it sold. It's a beautiful, you know, just blending of their voices. And maybe that was the reason why they just let their voices, you know, be the focal point. So that's Mary Wells. The next duet album that we get from Marvin is, it's called Take Two with Kim Weston. And in my opinion, I do believe that Marvin and Tammy just get all of the focus of, you know, and it's like the preference is given to Marvin and Tammy for Marvin's duet efforts, you know, his duet albums that were ever made. But in all honesty, in my sequence of getting my hands on all of Marvin's music, at one point I got this greatest hits is actually called like Marvin and His Girls. And so it was just this compilation disc of every duet partner that Marvin had had. And so there were a couple of songs on there from what he did with Kim Weston, and they're absolutely gorgeous. Oh, they're absolutely gorgeous. Those songs that I heard at that time as a teenager, I was maybe 16 by the time that I got that disc. And I just am captivated even till this day by those songs. Well, what has happened in 2019 is the full-on album, Take Two, is the first time that I'm ever being able to hear that entire album has been this year as I'm on Spotify. They have this album on Spotify. And so I'm still, to this minute in time right now, at this place where with Spotify, I am hearing songs for maybe the third or fourth time now on there. But I don't, that's not enough for me to know it inside and out. So it is still fresh enough that it's feeling like the first time that I hear it. And I feel like it was one morning as I was getting ready for work in here, I will put my, you know, Spotify on as I'm getting ready. And oh my gosh, this song from that album came on and it brings a tear to my eye. It is just so beautiful. Oh my goodness. What I'm trying to see. Oh, I'm looking at the wrong album. What that song is called. Oh, it is just so, 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 so beautiful. Let me see. I'm looking. I still don't. Heaven Sent You, I Know. Oh my gosh, people, listen to the song Heaven Sent You, I Know. I cry. It's so beautiful. Oh my goodness. So I'm a little bit hard pressed to just categorize it at Marvin's voice never blended beautifully, you know, and perfectly with another female partner like it did with Tammy Terrell, because there's just a few too many songs on this Kim Weston album that are just absolutely gorgeous. So, but let's look at where this album comes into play as well, because it kind of sort of is a little bit that same type of story of that there was a little bit of need, but not really, not as strong of a need as when the Mary Wells album came out. But okay, here we go again. Mary Wells, the three albums in April of 1964 hit right? It's the When I'm Alone, I Cry, The Greatest Hits, The Together with Mary Wells. The next album Marvin releases, oh, and I have to fall on my sword a little bit here. It's called Hello Broadway. It comes out in November of 1964. And now I just have to pause for a second and address this album. This album is something that in my years of Marvin Gaye acquisition collection, I've had access to. I have on purpose not bought the album. Okay. I just can't even almost admit that. I am a Marvin purist, I promise, but I'll tell you the reason why I just have not needed to get the album. Because I'm not a musical person. I cannot handle musical movies. That's not my thing. I have pointed out before, I'm an old movie aficionado. So really the heyday of musical movies is the 1950s in Hollywood. And I just promise you, I can't do that. I cannot handle a musical movie. I can watch Singing in the Rain and that's it. Okay. I don't do musicals. I don't do Broadway. I can't. Okay. It's for the fact this album is called Hello Broadway. And there's a song on here. And this is the song that it made the decision for me. It's called Hello Dolly. I can't even for Marvin. I just can't. And so I never have. Oh my goodness. But Spotify has given me my life. Spotify has put me in check. And I'm happy to say so. And so I am fully taking back my, you know, Marvin Gaye purist, Marvin Gaye expert title and part of the club. Okay. Can't take it away from me. I took it back. I did what I had to do and I'm back on board, because Hello Broadway is an album that is on Spotify. And so again, you know, I went into Spotify, I grabbed every single full on album of Marvin's that they have. And so then I just hit shuffle, right? I will happily let whatever is the next Marvin Gaye song come into my ear. Let's do that, please, all day long. So there have been, let me go to Hello Dolly. Let me don't even not address this. So one day, I'm starting to hear this little song playing that I've never heard before. And quickly, you know, well, Hello Dolly. And I was just like, oh, this is adorable. This is adorable. This is absolutely Marvin Gaye singing me any single thing on the planet, and it works, okay? Because if who do I think I am? I am a Marvin Gaye purist, so I don't know why in the world I thought that I couldn't go there with Marvin, okay? I can absolutely go there with Marvin. Hello Dolly is absolutely delightful. And there is another little song on this album that is absolutely adorable that, of course, I had never heard before, because I have not ever heard this entire album. And the first time that I heard this song come on, I, of course, realized that I have never heard this song before in my life. And I absolutely sat there captivated, didn't move, and just needed to hear that song, just fully absorb this song playing for me for the first time. And of course, I'm not looking at it, so I'm not even knowing that it's coming from this album. And I am just sitting there and I'm listening to this and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so adorable. It's just absolutely beautiful and adorable. And it is called On the Street Where You Live. Oh my goodness. This album. Now I'm going to tell you another factor into me just making this wrong decision years back that I did not need to buy this album is the fact that on the Marvin Gaye collection, the Balladeer Disc 4, they do have two songs from this album that are on there that I absolutely love and fell in love with upon immediate first hearing. But it was, I'm sorry, it was just the fact that the song said Hello Dolly, and I know that's a play that I absolutely, in a musical that I can't stand and I can't do it, so I couldn't buy the album. But, and then it was like, well, I already have two songs off of this album, so I'm going to call that good. It is What Kind of Fool Am I? Absolutely gorgeous song. And then The Days of Wine and Roses. And oh my gosh, I'm going to do an episode on that because there was just a most precious, prized moment that I had with my grandfather listening to that song. So, yeah, you know, but I had those two songs, knew that I loved them hardcore, and I felt like it was enough to still rep, you know, and ride with Marvin. But it wasn't, you know, and it just was not. And so I regret that, but I am back on board now because I have access to this album, and anything that ever comes up off of it is just absolutely a delightful experience. And I don't know who the hell I thought I was to think that I didn't need that album. Okay, but I do, and I did, and I have it now. So he does that in November of 64, and then he follows with a huge hit, but let's go back, you know, probably Marvin's mama bought that out. You know, the album didn't sell, okay? So, but he follows up the next album that he puts out, and he puts it out in about 2 months, I can see here, because he releases that in November of 64, and then in January of 65, they press out How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, and that's a major hit. He's got hit after hit after hit on that song, or that album. So, you know, he saved himself. He's got You're a Wonderful One, he's got How Sweet It Is, he's got Try It Baby, Baby Don't You Do It, I love that song. You know, so he saves himself. And then, that's January of 65. Then in November of 65, he releases a tribute to the great Nat King Cole. Again, you know, maybe his family bought that album, but that's it. And then in May of 66, he comes out with The Moods of Marvin Gaye. So, you know, major hits on that album. He's in great shape, right? Like, he's doing just fine. He's doing just fine. And then after The Moods of Marvin Gaye comes Take Two with Kim Weston in August of 1966. And that gives them one hit, the It Takes Two. And here's a thing that was just kind of a question that I had, though, about these duets, these two albums that we've gotten to so far with Mary Wells and Kim Weston. It was just kind of like, why didn't they record multiple albums together? You know what I'm saying? And when I have that question, I go to the context of Hollywood and a formula that works, right? It's like they would often pair two big stars together. They still do that to this day, right? Two big stars together, a man and a woman. And if it works out well, then hey, we've got a good formula that works. Let's keep going with this. Like the biggest example I can think of, you know, classic films is Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, right? They do their first movie together. It's anticipated. They're both huge stars. It's like, let's put them together. Are they going to have any chemistry? Are they going to, you know, pull it off? And they of course do. And then it's a formula that works. So they end up making 9 movies together, all together. And so it was just like kind of how I went to saying, you know, Marvin was solo. So why was it necessary for these duets to kind of happen, period? Well, you know, I explained and learned for myself, just I'm deducing this, I'm putting it together for myself, the need and the reason for the first duet album with Mary Wells, you know, that was just a, let's give you the best chance of success that we can here. With Kim Weston, it's not such a dire need like that. That's coming on the heels of an album that gave several hits for Marvin. And so did How Sweet It Is. Like, those two albums were great, strong sellers for Marvin. But then this Take Two with Kim Weston comes about. And I don't really think that Kim Weston herself had, like, some huge hits before she made this record with Marvin. And I go to what I said about just like how beautiful these songs were that they did make. Oh my God, I'm just stuck on, and I will say it again now that we are actually at that album again. Heaven Must Have Sent You. I know you have got to experience that. You have, oh my gosh, please listen to that song. And you know, so it was like, that was a beautiful, in my opinion, their voices sound delightful with each other. You know, that absolutely worked. That's a formula that works. And if you did it, you bothered to do it, And as long as, you know, it was going to be a bother to have Marvin record with someone a duet album again, like, why not go with Kim again? It worked. It sounds great. But I was thinking that somewhere, I believe I've heard, even from Kim Weston herself one time, I feel like I've seen a biography on Marvin, a documentary on Marvin before, where they were interviewing Kim. And I believe that she was kind of explaining that her career, she just kind of, I believe that she left Motown, is honestly what I think that happened. I also believe that I thought she was married to a pretty high up executive at Motown. And I think that maybe what happened, I feel like I thought I heard something about going to Europe. And, you know, just being a wife and a mother. And that was in the era where, you know, women, if they were doing wife and mother, sometimes, you know, there were most of the times situations where that was what they did. They were wives and mothers. They weren't also having some type of a career outside of the home. So I think it was, you know, a little bit of a lot of those scenarios that kind of played into why Kim Weston just, I believe, wasn't available to record with Marvin again. But so then the very next album that comes out after that duet record with Kim is this first album with Tammy Terrell in 1967. And so now let me get into that biography on Tammy, the documentary on Tammy that I told you I came across just Friday, which is 2 days ago now. And I went in search of it because, like I said, I knew I had seen it at the time that it was released on TV One. And so it was just this one day on TV One, I came across this documentary was coming on, and I was just glued to the TV because it gave such great in-depth background, backstory, finally shedding some light on just the inside story of what was going on in Tammy Terrell's life. I think, like, that's obviously what has always been kind of a missing part of this Wikipedia amount of information that has ever been available about Marvin and Tammy's experience with each other, right? And so I'm going to just espouse this really quick, because I'm pretty sure if anybody knows something about Marvin and Tammy Terrell, I'm going to be telling you stuff that you're going to be following right along with me, and you know you've heard this, and this is the extent that you've heard. You know, unless you've done your own really deep dive into it. But if you have, that has required you to go about digging and sussing out some additional information, because they keep it really high level all the time. What is the story, the tragic story with Marvin and Tammy, right? It's that one night in 1967, they're at a college in Virginia and they're performing, and Tammy collapses in Marvin's arms and Marvin carries her off of the stage, and then she dies. That's it, right? That's what they tell you. And that's leaving so many holes. That is not the complete story. It creates this folklore around them. It creates this heightened, you know, sensationalism around then, therefore, somebody being able to say, oh, our play is about the fact that Marvin Gaye was one person before Tammy Terrell died, and then he was another person after Tammy Terrell died. And it does, it leaves these gaps, and it sensationalizes it, where it's like, really? Okay. I don't get that, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm sorry, you would just be like, I don't get that, though. And did I explain, too, about how I saw this interview recently, just within the past week or so here, where I was seeing it again because I had seen it once before, but it was Jan Gay, where she is out selling and promoting her book when it came out. And it seemed like it wasn't even really in context of the whole entire interview, but it's like some just brief little snippet, it just kind of got introduced into the conversation, which didn't really feel like it had been about this. But the guy was mentioning something about Tammy, and Jan said that, to the effect, you know, I'm paraphrasing, that Marvin loved Tammy very, very deeply, and he told her that, and he never kept that from her. And That was just an that her saying that was again something like, I don't get that. I don't get it. Like, what? You know what I mean? Because what you would have observed, you know, just through whatever's been reported, right, about Marvin and Janice's relationship is that Janice is the love of Marvin's life, right? Janice is the one that inspired his music, you know, from the time that he met her until he died, right? Like, he just was, Janice is who he would say something like that about. You know, it was the part where she says that, you know, and he never kept that from me. That was the part that was just, it was like, well, what do you mean? Like, why would he have to? And it gets me to the folklore elements about Marvin and Tammy, right? Where it's things that don't match, right? It's things that don't match. It's things that are reported. And then it's little insights like that from people where it's like, it doesn't match to me. I don't get the reason why you would say that Marvin was one person before Tammy died, and then he was another person after Tammy died. And I'm going to tell you the gap that I'm explaining is missing here. It's that anytime you get some type of commentary from people that knew Marvin and Tammy at the time, there is this over the top kind of seeming like out of the way explanation and kind of like an even unasked for explanation that always comes from people explaining that it's like this is just something unsolicited that people always throw in there. Oh, but you know, they weren't really in love, you know, or and nothing really happened between them outside of the studio. And, you know, they didn't really have a real relationship in real life, you know, and it's just like people are always kind of very protectively trying to throw that little caveat, that little disclaimer into any type of conversation that they're going to have about the magic of Marvin and Tammy's music. And I think that like, why that creates folklore is because I think what the public in general kind of wants to run with just on their own, just kind of like totally contradictory to having that little disclaimer thrown in there, is that you do kind of want to feel like there had to have been something real there going on between Marvin and Tammy to inspire and make it possible that that music had so much depth to it. And you want to feel like that's coming from a real place because it feels so real. It is so genuine. Like there's, if it's true that, you know, nothing ever happened between the two of them, no matter what, that music is so genuine. They just weren't able to give us not genuine performances there. And so, but here's where I get to what I pointed out on that previous episode where I really felt the need to break down to you what will never be a part of this series, which is anything salacious. So here's my take on, like I said, these unsolicited, unasked for little disclaimers that people that knew Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell and were close to that situation always themselves feel the need to throw into any type of conversation about what existed between Marvin and Tammy, you know, is that they go out of their way to make sure we understand that nothing more happened between Marvin and Tammy than what took place in the studio. And here's how I'm going to just speak to that. Guess what, then? That's none of our business. You know what I mean? It's just like, okay, so you know what? Let's move on. Because clearly people who would know are not going to speak to it, you know? And therefore, that just lets me know it's none of my business. And I need to just be able to process whatever's going on in this music aside from that. You know what I'm saying? So let's just keep it moving. So, you know, because it's like we're not going to get any confirmation. And I refuse to speculate against the only thing that's ever being reported about that situation. But here is where I'm able finally, and where I said is the need for this episode right here to come into place first before I can move forward into music Marvin made beyond this time frame. Okay. I can say from my knowledge of Marvin's music and who, you know, Marvin was as a person through what I'm sorry you would have to be able to get elements of from Marvin's music. He had this strong responsibility that he felt to his musical gift. Okay. And what I'm thinking about when I'm saying this is this documentary that was made about Marvin when he was in Ostend, I believe that's how you pronounce it, Belgium, Ostend, Belgium, in the 1980s. In 1981, he was there and he was recuperating and he was rejuvenating himself. And we'll just leave it at that. You know what I mean? And that's what he was doing there. And in the course of doing that, you know, he just was coming back into the health of his gift for sure. And he's, like I said, this documentary is being made about him. And I actually had an ability to converse with the maker of that movie. I feel like this is in the year 2009. I have an email from this man. And for some reason, in the year 2009, I came across online somewhere the fact that this man had made this movie about Marvin Gaye. And so, of course, that was something that completely piqued my interest. And somehow, there was just the contact information for this man. His name is Richard Olivier. I believe it's Olivier is how you'd pronounce it, because he's French, Belgium, you know, I believe that would be the pronunciation of the name. And it just, like I said, it had his contact information. You could just email him and request to get information about getting us a purchase, you know, of this movie that he made of Marvin Gaye. And so I reached out to him and I was just asking him, what was this movie? And he explained to me, he was like, yes, I made a movie. It's called Remember Marvin Gaye. And I would be happy to sell you a copy of it for however many euros. And I just remember, like, I think that experience right there was just a little bit too real and too intense for me, and feeling a little bit too much exclusive. Like, I would just be able to get my hands on something a little bit too exclusive of Marvin Gaye. I'm sorry. It's like it was, I'm like having a strong reaction to that even right now. It just, it felt a little bit too real. It was like, oh my gosh, dude, like, I don't even know if I can do that. You know, there was something about that that gave me pause. Like, I just couldn't move forward with getting that. I'm going to explain to you why that is. And it's very stupid, but it's, it's me. I'm going to keep this very short. I'm a collector of Cary Grant movies. Cary Grant made 72 films. Many of them are not available on DVD. There is a website. There is a group of hardcore Cary Grant fans. There is this one lady who has every single one of Cary Grant's movies, and she will make you her own personal DVD copy of a movie, and she'll mail it to you. $12 a movie. And so, oh my gosh, I came across this because there is a very large portion of Cary Grant's catalog that you just can't even buy. I'm telling you, struggle is real. Struggle is real. And so I reached out to this lady, and I very slowly began, movie by movie, buying these unreleased. I can't get it anywhere but from this lady who is going to take her own copy of the movie and burn a DVD of it and mail it to me in the mail. And I went very, very slowly because there was just something too much to handle about getting to the place of getting the 72 movies in my possession. But I did get to that place, and I got them from her. And I actually, you know what? It goes to what I'm saying right here about how I couldn't buy this Marvin Gaye movie. I actually even kept myself from really legitimately getting to the place of having the 72 Cary Grant movies because I left one out. I still do not own one Cary Grant movie because I can buy that off of Amazon, or I can just go, you know, find that someplace. But I kind of just can't have that one yet. There's something finite about it, right? There's something final. There's something when you have just gone about doing something for so long and you do want to get, there's something sad about getting there. And so even with all of these Cary Grant movies that I have piece by piece ordered from this woman, and I've got, I like on purpose haven't watched these movies. There's a good five or six of the movies of Cary Grant's that I own that are right here in my house that I refuse to watch them. I'm not going to watch them until it is some type of a monumental life experience and I just need to commemorate it with a, let's watch one more Cary Grant movie that I've never seen before. Let me hear one more Marvin Gaye song that I've never heard before. People, this is real for me. You know what I mean? It's on another tip. Maybe you can't even get your mind around what I'm saying right now, but it was when I came across talking to this director of this movie. I couldn't buy his movie. I couldn't do it. So I didn't go any further with it than that. But, I have a couple of years ago come across the movie anyway. And then just within the past month or so here, I came across it on YouTube again. And I've got it and I'll put it on my Pinterest page. But it's in this movie, okay? So this is what I'm talking about. The movie that I could not buy, I'm watching just a week or so ago. And Marvin is in the movie and he's being interviewed. It's a documentary about Marvin where Marvin is in the movie. He is being filmed and he is speaking and he is singing. And I'm sure you've probably, if you have seen, you're pretty deep into your study of Marvin, you've seen him in the church singing the Lord's Prayer. This is the movie that's from. So there is, I am explaining to you, Marvin is an artist and he is a pure artist. He is a gift from God level artist. And Marvin is speaking to that in this movie. And I'm going to be totally paraphrasing. I'm going to be saying this to you in my take of what Marvin was saying. But I do remember that Marvin used the word intelligence of God. He used the phrase, the intelligence of God. He was saying that he knows that he has a gift from God and that actually his gift from God and his use of his gift of God is an expression of the intelligence of God. I could like drop the mic right now. Do you? So from there, he went a little bit further to just explain that, he knows that he has a musical ability gift that sets him a step aside. I'm paraphrasing again, from the average man, right? The average human being does not have the vocal ability that he has. But people, can we amen to that? Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, not only is that an accurate statement, Marvin, okay? Because that's like the biggest downplay that I've ever heard in my life. You know, like we could just put that on a shirt or something. But let's go back to the first part of what he said, that his gift that he knows that he has from God is an expression of God's intelligence. He knew that hand in hand with that was this heavy level of responsibility, okay? And that is how real Marvin's music and him being a musician and an artist was to Marvin. Okay, this is the level that we're dealing with here, people, okay? This is not a joke for Marvin, okay? I have to convey that to you and break that down to you and establish that before we now move to the level. Let me go back to what I said about, but that doesn't make sense, that Marvin Gaye was one person when Tammy Terrell was in his life and then he became another person when Tammy Terrell was not in his life, but that doesn't make sense, right? And I'm not getting any type of reporting anywhere that something outside of the studio happened between Marvin and Tammy. So that still does not allow that statement to make sense. You know what I'm saying? It's like, because I've never gotten the report of the relationship that existed between Marvin and Tammy outside of the studio for that statement that you made to make sense. It does not make sense for the love of Marvin Gaye's life, Janice Gaye, to make a statement
that Marvin told her that he loved Tammy very, very, very deeply, and he never kept that from her. To say that in that way, it does not make sense. But what I just broke down about what Marvin understood about his gift and the responsibility that he had with his musical gift, that's Marvin's life. Marvin sings that in his songs. Music is my heart and my soul. It's more precious than gold. You know, he's told you what this is. It's not a joke. For Marvin to come across in his lifetime another performing artist that he gets the ability to sing with that is on his matched level, that's going to be your reason why, okay? That's the reason why. This now makes sense. We are now able to get this to make sense. Like I said, we can mind our business about anything extracurricular. But when we understand how important and how real Marvin's gift, Marvin's artistic responsibility is that he has, for the fact that in his lifetime, he was able to encounter and partner with another human being that was on the same gift from God level as he was. Yeah, that's the reason why. He was one person when she was in his life, and he was another person for the rest of his life once she was no longer here. And so, the song that will explain what I am talking to you about that you need to hear is called I Will Never Stop Loving You, Baby, on the 1968 You're All I Need album. It is song 11 on that track. It is 3 minutes and 24 seconds long. And it is within the last 20 seconds of that song that you will understand what I'm talking about that existed between Marvin and Tammy. Let me just point out some little trivial highlights from that TV One Unsung documentary about the two of them that will further break this down. And then I'm wrapping this up. They record United in 1967, and it makes me wonder if this was the process that the album with Mary Wells and Kim Weston was. That Tammy laid down her tracks, Marvin laid down his tracks. They were not singing to each other. They were not in the studio at the same time. They might not even been in the studio on the same day. I do my thing, you do your thing. Engineers come in, they mix it. Boom, here's our record. You know what I'm saying? We did not perform together. And so I wonder if Marvin performed with Mary, if Marvin performed with Kim, but he did not perform with Tammy on their very first album together. Yet that creates their probably biggest known hit, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. So now off of the success of that, though, let me go back to my little chronology here, because I believe this was something that was interesting. So they make United in 1967. That's immediately followed, same month. Oh gosh, Motown was giving Marvin records in the same month all the time. So in August of 67, they release United. In August of 67, what do? They give us Marvin Gaye's Greatest Hits Volume 2. But again, the writing is not on the wall. That's not what this is for. They're just really spoiling us, right? They're just giving us Marvin hits. So then the next album that comes out is in August of 68, and that is You're All I Need with Tammy Terrell. So now they did. This is where it makes sense. This is what I'm talking about. Wait a minute. You have a thing that's working. You have a formula. Follow up with it. And so they did. They followed up this formula. They released the very next album of fresh material of Marvin is a new album with Tammy. Well, in this documentary, they reveal that, okay, Tammy collapses into Marvin's arms in 67. That's on the time of their first album together. In response to that, they take her to the hospital. She starts to get her testing done. That's the first time that she's diagnosed with this brain
cancer that she has. She has a tumor in her brain and it is a cancer. So they began to perform surgeries to try and remove the tumor. In the course of trying to treat Tammy Terrell, they give her 8 separate surgeries in her brain. The doctor that was operating on her was being interviewed, and he said that for anybody else, there's no way that they would have operated on somebody that many times, and that from the beginning, they kept her diagnosis from her even. They knew that her cancer was not going to be able to really be cured. But he said, he broke it, the doctor said it, and I can't even believe that a doctor would say this, but this just goes to explain what was going on. He's like, but this was Tammy Terrell. He's like, we were doing everything that we could. And towards the end, it was always just doing what they could to keep her comfortable because this was massively painful for her. So by the time that they get to recording You're All I Need, which is released in 68, she's had her first surgery on her brain. And back in those days, dude, that could not have been the most precise type of procedure. So she comes in to record this album and she's completely self-conscious because she's worried about how it's going to affect her vocal ability. And so they were interviewing Nick and Valerie in, what is it, Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson in this documentary on Tammy, who are the ones that wrote and produced all of these albums with Marvin and Tammy. So they're, who is going to know? They're in the studio with these guys. They're writing these songs and producing these songs and in the studio with them, getting the recordings out of them. So, you know, they are the ones that explained she had absolutely nothing to worry about. She is completely flawless on this album. So from there, she continues to have, you know, multiple surgeries, in total 8 surgeries. And she's in really, really bad shape at one point, to where they said she's down to 93 pounds. She's in a wheelchair. She can't stand. She doesn't have her strength. And based on that, for a while now, right? She's in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania getting the surgeries done. And she's done, right? She does not have the energy or the, you know, the health to be touring, to be in the studio recording. She's basically not at Motown anymore, right? Because she's too sick to do it. But in the course of doing that, she wants to come back and record one more album with Marvin. She really wanted to do that. And everybody knew she wasn't healthy enough to do that. But to just let Tammy have what she needed, they let her come back and do it, right? So she comes back, but she's down to 93 pounds and she's just in pain, right? So she comes to record and she's doing the album Easy. And it's released in November of 1969. And she's in bad shape. And so you can hear the difference in the vocal performances from the first 2 albums to this one. And there's in Marvin Gaye's semi-autobiography, Divided Soul, the question gets posed to him of, and this is another part of folklore, you know, where this is a rumor that has, you know, been sensationalized and just a part of this tragic story of Tammy. The story that you may have heard or that has been circulated is that when it came to this album Easy, that she wasn't recording. It wasn't her. It's actually Valerie Simpson that's recording in her place. And that's what got released under the guise that this is a Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell album. And so Marvin is asked about that in this book. And I don't have this in front of me, but I know what I read when I first read this. And I know what I took away from that. Marvin, I'm paraphrasing this, but he's explaining that at that time he was so despondent and he was just so, you know, not able to be fully present in his heart and in his soul in, you know, seeing Tammy in this shape and just being a part of this album. And, you know, he can't remember. That's what he said. And from somehow, from that response from Marvin, it gets processed and printed and distributed and circulated that, and even it's what is explained in this documentary on TV One about Tammy Terrell. They lead by saying, in later years, Marvin Gaye reported that it was actually Valerie Simpson who recorded all of Tammy's vocals and the album got released saying that it was Tammy. And so now they pan over to Valerie and she's trying to dispute this. Well, Marvin never said that, Okay. Marvin said he was so out of it. He was so, you know, just distraught by seeing his musical soulmate, right, in this shape. He can't remember what the heck was going on, you know, to get this album finished. And so Valerie points out that no, she's like, I would get into the booth and I would sing with Marvin to rehearse the songs, to like just get it rehearsed. But we were always able to get one-on-one with Tammy and get what we needed out of Tammy to actually, you know, record the song. So she's like, it's Tammy that you hear on the album. That is Tammy. It's not me. And the reason why you would have that question as to whether it was Tammy is because I guarantee you, Tammy does sound weak. She sounds different. It does not sound like the first two albums, but I just gave you the context of why. She was down to 93 pounds and she had already had, I would say, half of those 8 surgeries done on her by that point in time. They were appeasing Tammy. They were like last wishing Tammy. You know what I mean? That's what that album was about. So actually, let me look at one thing on this album. I want to see if a certain song is on here. Yes. Oh my God. So I just, you know, one thing to keep in mind and to listen to from that album, that being the story of that album and the shape that Tammy was in that album, I would say the most beautiful song that Marvin and Tammy made is called Love Woke Me Up This Morning. And that is on that song. Oh my gosh, I don't want to cry. But that being the story of where all of that was coming from, oh, that song is so, 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 so beautiful. It's their most beautiful song, period. But the reason why I'm going to tell you to listen to the title of this episode song, I'll Never Stop Loving You, Baby, is one last thing from that documentary that got pointed out that is very contextual about Marvin and Tammy. I have explained Marvin meets his musical soulmate, right? It's not a joke to him. It's on this level of responsibility, his musical gift that he has. He's not going to come across many people that are his peer like that. He came across that in Tammy. One thing that was fun for them, they were having the time of their lives doing this. That's the reason why Marvin is one person and another person once he loses his musical soulmate like that. Once he found her and he had access to her, they were having the time of their lives, and it was very competitive for the two of them because they could match each other. They could try and outdo each other, and that's what they were doing. Like, that's what they're giving to us, is they're competing with each other. They're being cocky with each other. They're showing off to each other as they're starting to sing. And so the difference is that on this album, You're All I Need, is what changed in their performing these songs is they are finally in the studio together. And somebody pointed this out on that documentary. They're singing into the same microphone. Now, see, that's even on another level. I could see them being in the same studio together finally and like actually singing to each other, but I'm on my mic and you're on yours. No, they were singing into the same microphone. So an example of this competitiveness, which you just have to hear this too, is on the album comes out in 1970. It's Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell's Greatest Hits. So actually this song must have come from a previous album that they've already recorded, but it's on that disc. It is the last song on that whole album. It's called Hold Me, Oh My Darling. And the way that I'm talking to you about how they competed with each other and just were like, now what? You know what I'm saying? Marvin says to her, he said, now what you gotta say? And what he means by that is like, now he needs her to sing back, right? Sing your part. And so then here she came, right? And then she took it as a challenge, you know, but he literally says that. He's like, now what you gotta say? And so it's just like, yes. Oh my goodness. Because this is what I'm saying to you. Like, this is what causes the folklore. Like, hearing these two powerhouses singing to each other is the equivalent of, you know what it's the equivalent of. And that's the reason why there's this folklore. And that's the reason why there's just this urban legend myth going on about what else. You know what I mean? And so the song that explains the depth of what I'm talking about here, the song that would break this down to you, where how I just said, but that doesn't make sense, and I don't understand why. Is Marvin one person when Tammy's alive, and then he's another person when she's not here anymore? If you need to have a demonstration of what is really going on, it is I'll Never Stop Loving You, Baby, which is song 11 on the You're All I Need album. And they are losing their minds singing to each other. This song, they are literally going hard into singing to each other. They are singing each other's names to each other throughout the song. Tammy! And then she's just coming back at him with Marvin. And what I'm telling you is listen until... And I think it's even closer than the last 20 seconds of the song. But she sings, and it's in a way, Tammy Terrell, I would be surprised to hear in her catalog where she sang this strongly, this passionately, this loudly, this hard, this aggressively, this just, I am telling you what I mean, Lee. And it's, like I said, it's probably within less than the last 20 seconds of that song where now with all of this context and hearing that song is your explanation of why Marvin Gaye was one person when she was in his life and then he was another person when she was gone. Thank you for listening. This one was a little bit longer. Enjoy that.
Well, friends, that's it for this episode. Did we have fun? I had fun. Subscribe to our show so you never miss the enduring gifts of Marvin Gaye. And we're excited to announce that you can follow us on Pinterest at our page, pinterest.com/MarvinGaye_enduring_gifts. There, you can see our gorgeous picture boards for each podcast episode, among many others. These boards are full of images of Marvin capturing key moments from each episode. We're making this a listening and viewing experience for you. So until next time, thank you for listening.